Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Juniors. You have not really lived until you've had cheesecake at Juniors. For more information, visit juniorscheesecake.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Craig.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in and around New York City. And our show aims to bring a little bit of culture to horticulture every week. And in fact, this week is the last week that we're working in the gardens in New York. The weather has been like so many other places in the Northeast and the Southeast and the Midwest, unseasonably warm. So we've been getting a lot of work done, and we're kind of grateful for that. It hasn't been bitter cold. So this is it. And then we go into what one, our friend Rochelle Greer said, the fertile darkness.
That's right.
That's how she described winter.
But first, we just have to, how many tons of soil are we blowing in?
Oh, tomorrow, I have to think about it. 500 cubic feet times 50 pounds. So what, 25,000?
Yeah.
Some odd pounds.
That we're blowing in
some soil.
We're ending the year with a soil blowing hurrah.
Yes. In the middle of Midtown Manhattan.
72nd Street.
Oh my God. Anyway, so let's get some business out of the way. Today's winner of the weekly Timber Press book giveaway is our Instagram follower, Sage Friedman. She's won Kelly Norris's book. And Kelly's going to be on the show today. Sage is at Sagesaurus, which is such a great handle. I love it. Sage, get in touch with us, and Timber will send out the book. So a couple of weeks ago, Alice and I went to New England Grows, and I'm going to editorialize for a minute.
It was actually more like New England Mows.
New England Mows. I'm sorry, but I was a little bit disappointed and a little bit sad. We came away with some interesting new sources for some products and materials, and we actually attended a couple of really great lectures, but there was very little horticulture at that show.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, I think it was, this is two shows that they did in one year.
Yes,
because
yeah.
They're trying to figure out the
timing
when the best
time.
Of it.
Yeah.
It used to be in February up in Boston, and it's gotten snowed out over the last couple of years. So it was great to do it in February or in December this
yes,
year.
Yeah.
But I think two shows back to back is a little tough
for
vendors.
It was, yeah. And I think that's why there were very few local nurseries, which is one of the reasons Alice and I love to go and look at new varieties.
Well, because December is like May, actually.
Yeah.
Remember?
They're selling their they're selling their Christmas trees and their greens.
They're putting their plants to bed for the winter.
Yeah. So it's a tough time to have. So we're gonna kinda watch and see what happens with the show.
But there was a lot of machinery.
I mean, mowing machines, snow blowing machines, but there were some fun things.
Chainsaw competitions. Silky saw, a lot of paving.
Yeah, there were a lot of attractive young men in harnesses. I'm just going to say that as
a
positive.
There was some acrobatic
young men climbing
skills.
Yeah,
chainsaw skills.
So you know, if that and ladies, you know, and
if
men,
you're single
if
and you're
single,
looking for somebody
look for some plaid burly dudes. I mean, that was like
khaki
90
wearing,
fleece wearing.
It was a really fun show.
It was fun. It was fun. So they have to guess, they have to figure out how they're going to put some horticulture back into it, I think.
Put some grow back into New England
into
grows.
New England grows. So today I feel like we're going to get our dose of horticulture that we missed at the show.
Sure enough.
And because for Alice and I, plants are paramount in the design of landscapes, and they're at the center of our professional lives. So it's fitting that today's guest is first and foremost a plantsman with a respect for all that is beautiful and unique in our regional and national landscapes. Kelly Norris is on the show. We met Kelly a few years ago at Plantarama, where he was on a panel of speakers coordinated by Ken Drews on new voices in horticulture. And since then, we've gotten to know him a little bit. We saw him again at the Garden Writers Conference in Pittsburgh.
And we're fabulous Facebook friends.
Yes, we are. And Kelly he's a very snazzy dresser, so he stands out in a crowd. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you very much.
And also, congratulations on winning the gold at the Garden Writers.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It was definitely an honor to do it. Two in a row now, so
yeah.
we're very excited.
You're on a good...
You're going to have a crowded mantle, young man. I just have a feeling.
Well, it's already necessitated the discussion here at work about where we're going to start putting these things.
There's
we're
gold
gonna,
in
we're
them
We're
going
to need a little hills. Shelf or something.
That's right.
Oh, exactly. So, Alice, will you tell our listeners a little bit about Kelly? I had to abbreviate the bio because it was amazing, but I kind of hit the highlights.
Okay, so Kelly D. Norris is a 20-something award-winning author and plantsman from Iowa and the first director of horticulture at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, a newly revitalized 14-acre public garden in Des Moines, Iowa. He's popularly known for his book, A Guide to Bearded Irises, Cultivating the Rainbow for Beginners and Enthusiasts from Timber Press, which won the 2013 American Horticultural Society Book Award. His next book, Plants with Style, is out this month. As speaker, he has garnered acclaim for his high-energy, zealous presentations on the national stage, leading many to call him one of the rising stars of American horticulture. Kelly's career began at age 15 when he talked his parents into buying a nursery, Rainbow Iris Farm, and since then he's become one of the few gurus on marketing horticulture to emerging demographics. Kelly is also the youngest person to receive the Iowa State Horticultural Society's Presidential Citation, Award of Merit, and Honor Award in the organization's 150-year history, awards that exemplify service and contributions to horticulture in Iowa. In 2011, he was also honored by the Perennial Plant Association with the Young Professional Award, recognizing early contributions to the advancement of herbaceous perennials in American horticulture.
Okay, that's the abbreviated bio, okay?
And how old are you, right?
And he's 25, yeah. All right? So wait, before we get into the meaty questions, Kelly, I have a 16-year-old son, and there is no way that he would talk me into anything. So I want to know, first of all, how you convinced your parents to buy an iris farm. Okay, I want the background on this.
Well, so I always tell people at this point of the story that you can decide before I even say anything who's crazier, me or my parents. This was it was an interesting conversation. So we'll have to go back. I was about 15, and mm-hmm. I found online on a listserv back in the day when those still existed about irises that a nursery near Austin, Texas, was up for sale, and it was called Rainbow Iris Farm. And I had always wanted, that was my dream as a teenager, was to run a nursery. And so I printed off this email, and I said I put it in my pocket, and I said to myself, I'm going to pitch this at dinner. And I did.
Over the mashed potatoes.
And my dad was the first to respond, who I thought might be the most doubting, maybe, and said, yeah, sure, go give him a call. See what they say.
Oh, wow.
Thinking in his head that, this would be one of those humbling experiences in life where you would call and, an adult would pick up and laugh and hang up the phone or something. And
right.
So I made that phone call, and they didn't laugh, and they didn't hang up, and a month later, we were on our way to Austin, Texas to spend a weekend with these people who have, you know, since become, of course, very dear family friends, and kind of experience what it was like to run an Irish nursery for a weekend. And a few weeks after that, about 40,000 Irish rhizomes were headed north on a semi-trailer to our farm in southwest Iowa, and thus began Rainbow Iris Farm. So
wow.
So tell us a little bit about your kind of earlier childhood. So you grew up in horticulture.
Well, I mean, I grew up as a kid who loved gardening. My parents were farmers. My dad still runs a construction business. So I mean, we were close to the land, and obviously growing up in rural southwest Iowa, I mean, agriculture is just the way of life. I mean, so, you know, we were close to the land. I love being outside. I love nature. I love exploring the woods behind our house and discovering mm-hmm. spring ephemerals and, you know, all that kind of thing in the springtime. And my seminal gardening experiences were really with my maternal grandmother when I was, you know, 4 years old, planting squash seeds or collecting 4 o'clock seeds or something. And,
yeah.
You know, so I've always been a plant geek, and horticulture was sort of my career path. Before I knew there was such a thing as a career path, it's my life. So
that's awesome.
That's amazing. And those are the kinds of things that we always ask our guests, because some people come to it later in life as a second mm-hmm. career. Some people come to it from other, like, just very unhorticulture, unlandscaped or design fields, and they just get a passion for it. And it's very interesting. Your story is very interesting, and it really touched me, because I am living with an adolescent, like I said, and I was like, this is so interesting that your parents, like, believed in it and supported it. Mm-hmm. You know, Kelly, that is like an amazing thing. You know,
yeah.
that they did.
Yeah, I truly do count that among the blessings in my life, that my parents have always been very supportive, and supportive of just letting me be me, because I'm a little hard to probably put in a box some days and describe exactly what I am or what I do. And so I've been blessed in that respect, that they've given me the freedom to grow up like that. So
yeah. And then you wrote the book on irises.
Yes.
And the Rainbow Iris Farm is still in existence and still running. Yes.
It is. We still, we've actually are in the process of really trying to focus the business on our breeding work. My training is as a plant breeder, and so my real interest in irises, bearded irises, and specifically is creating new varieties. And so, you know, we really are trying to kind of focus the work of our nursery on promoting those new varieties and doing that. So we're fortunate to have been recognized by Martha Stewart here just a few months ago as one of her American Made winners, and so which is a really honorable milestone to come to after, you know, almost 13 years in business. And
that is amazing.
Past 13 years in business, I guess. So, irises are still a very, very important part of my life.
I want to know what your college essay was about to get into college.
I'm not even sure I could remember. Off the top of my head.
Can you imagine that paper coming across like some administrator's desk? Like,
yeah,
let me tell you about the bearded iris.
Yeah.
You know, I probably pontificated on some level about planting the world a more beautiful place, because that's truly the belief that kind of is the motivation of my life, professionally or otherwise. Is you know, there's a lot of things in this world that cast a dark cloud over our lives, but gardens and plants are certainly not one of those things. So we're the easiest route to happiness for most people out there. So
I couldn't agree more. Well, I'm sure that your tastes have evolved enormously since your adolescent self. So how has your sort of ideas and taste evolved and changed as you've literally grown and developed the business and developed yourself professionally?
Yeah, that's a great question. I
Because you have strong opinions, you know, about...
Yeah, well, I have very strong opinions. And, I you know, one of the things when I was in graduate school and I was teaching undergraduates herbaceous plant ID, it's really interesting in that kind of formative stage of a young professional sort of career is to be learning plants and developing an idea for how they either, you know, grow them or use them or, you know, depending on what their emphasis was in the profession or the trade. And I always encourage people to have opinions about plants and gardens. I think it's right to cultivate an educated opinion about these things, because I think the more that we can increase the personal involvement that people have with the plants and that they garden with, the more narrative and more meaningful those spaces become, and that's one of the dominant themes of the book. I mean, for me personally, one of the things I keep looking for in plants and in the work that I do in the field, if I'm exploring and looking for new germplasm to bring into the trade, or if I'm talking to, you know, young people, or if I'm talking to gardeners, I want plants that have this notion of style, that have an endurance about them, that have a resilience, that are not things that just simply survive. I mean, that mm-hmm. are truly plants that thrive. But from an aesthetic standpoint, I want a plant that has some enduring ornamental value, that isn't just something is going to be a fad, that I'm going to get tired of, that there's, in a way, a timelessness about it.
Yes.
I don't know, and I think the other thing I'm always looking for, too, is a sense of wildness, some connection to a greater nature that I'm always looking to have in my midst, personally, or even in a public garden like here at the Botanical Garden.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying, and we get calls for that, too, and I think... In New York, and then I think worldwide, the Highline and Pete Udolph's work really changed the direction of American horticultural style.
Sure.
And you're taking it the next step further. You're saying, like, not just in public gardens, but make plants the center of everyone's outdoor space style.
Exactly, and I think one of the things, and it's really great that you bring up the Highline. I think one of the things that's really great about Pete's work and the work of so many other designers working in what's variously called the New Naturalism or New Perennial movement is, we're doing these kinds of projects on a major public scale that's exposing lots of people to these ideas. There's a couple of things that are down the pike. I mean, one is relating that to personal scale. I mean, we haven't seen a lot yet in print or etc. that really has taken that style and put it on a scale that most people have access to. I mean, on a couple thousand square feet of a lot, or maybe even significantly less in a major city like New York.
Yeah.
And I think the other piece to it, too, is that before we can really appeal to people's ecological consciousness or ecological awareness about the purpose and the good of creating the communities of plants in a more sustainable ethic, we have to relate it to the people factor first. Mm-hmm. I so often say that horticulture is an act of humanity. It's about people, plants, and passion. And there has to be something human about it. I mean, there has to be a relatability. And I think the first place that starts, as I espouse, I hope very strongly in this book, is that if we appeal to people's stylistic consciousness, if we appeal to their desire to express themselves through the plants in the medium of the garden, we create a much more visceral relationship with the land. We create a narrative, a personal narrative, mm-hmm. That results in gardens that are emotional and romantic. And I think that's what people crave. I think that's what we really need in gardens.
In fact, you have a quote from in the introduction from Thomas Church, his book Gardens Are for People, that was written in 1955, and I think it encapsulates what you're saying really, really well. Landscaping is not a complex and difficult art to be practiced only by high priests. It is logical, down to earth, and aimed at making your plot of ground produce exactly what you want and need from it. And I think that's a great way to begin your book, and it really, you know, encapsulates your ideas of appeal to people's need for beauty, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah.
to the belief that they can do it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And we're garden designers and we're saying this, you know, but the best gardens are the ones where we can see the client's
personal hand
in it. And the ones that aren't as successful, I think, are the ones that look like somebody else made it for them.
Right.
And
yeah.
they're not touching it, and they're not and they're afraid of it almost, you know?
Well, this is interesting because I'm thinking about how people kind of when they're young and they identify themselves with music or with a sports team. And
yeah.
What if people identified themselves with a genus of plants?
Yes.
Instead of like, you know,
just
like some sports team or like, how about them Yankees or, you know, how about them yuccas, you know?
Yeah. you know?
Or like, hey, did you
love that idea?
Did you hear the new? Did you hear the new?
And I think actually, you know, you really strike at something though that I feel like I come back to at many points in the book is this idea of personality and mm-hmm. that I mean plants have personalities. Sure, it's an anthropomorphizing of plants in, right. to some level, but you know, gardens have distinct personalities. I mean, gardens should be expressions of their creators. If they're not that, I don't know what they are then.
They're
things, as you say, might be that are just applied to the landscape, that they're just plants and ideas and arrangements that are applied to the landscape. And I think for so long we've thought about gardening as if these were just sort of inert pieces that we arranged and put together in a way that we found pleasing, that we didn't think about the greater depth of the fact that they're living beings, and mm-hmm. that the reality is that this isn't high science. I mean, there's great science, there's fascinating science behind all this, and that's one of my other passions, is distilling the function of this so that people have an appreciation for what's going on beneath the surface, how it works, so to speak. But this is really, you know, this idea of a manifesto for modern gardening, as I sort of, you know, chart off with in the introduction, is really about finding a way to reshape the tone and the approach about how we make gardens and really why we make gardens. It's, the,
yeah.
it's why they're relevant and why they're important. You know, the details of how they come together that's all over the book. I mean, that's the plants themselves. But the why I really wanted to set the pace with right out the gate from the book.
And it ties into purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Gardening with a purpose. Isn't that right, Kelly?
That's
like
right.
It's not just to beautify, but I think people, this new generation of gardeners, wants to garden with a purpose. That's why the edible movement is extremely popular and people are wanting
yes.
to grow things to eat. But
yeah.
there's a disconnect with the ornamental part
mm-hmm.
because they see it as frivolous perhaps or not, or maybe even intimidating, you know?
Yeah.
So I think people are coming at it from lots of different directions, and your book is so refreshing because as designers, so many times Alice and I are frustrated because the client is focused on the furniture and not the landscape. And
right.
they were like, will this piece of furniture fit in there? And we're just like tearing our hair out saying, oh my God, like, yes, of course you want to sit in the garden and appreciate it and, you know, have room for your table, but the plants are first, you know, for
yeah.
us, and it's maddening. It's like, when are you people going to get it, you know?
Well, I mean, yeah. I, the idea of gardening with purpose, I very yeah. clearly make a case for
yes.
it in the beginning, and I think in so many ways, I probably have a lot more to say about that. I have, and maybe that'll come out in a book that follows, but I really truly believe that is what is palpable about the market attitude in gardening today, and I think particularly espoused so by, you know, younger generations, millennials or what have you. And I think that part of that is because we live in a world that has so many options. We have access to so many things. There's been a great democratization of the way in which we encounter information and activity in our life. And I think that when you really sit down and take all that in, we're really searching for things that have the greatest meaning to occupy our time with. There's a lot of ways in which our lives can get sidetracked by the frivolous substanceless things in life.
Yeah,
gardening,
right.
absolutely, whether for sustenance or for enjoyment, is absolutely not one of those. And I think that that objective of thinking about a greater sense of a garden than you know, plants can do more than just feed us. They can do more than just be pretty. They can clean our water. They can clean our air. They can provide food to wildlife and pollinators. They can give us great pleasure and joy in the same sense. And we can nibble on them too. Like, I mean, in so many ways, the market today, I think, lays at the feet of the garden or the landscape in concept. It must do all of these things. And the greatest thing is that it can, because plants, there are 250,000 species or more of flowering plants on this planet, and there is great function and capacity to be able to create dynamic landscapes with them.
So let's talk about, because you're touching on a lot of things. Let's talk about the plant people and then the design people, because sometimes the camps don't meet. In a great world, the camps meet in the center, and sometimes that happens.
But sometimes they don't intersect.
No, and a lot of times, like Carmen and I will, you know, as designers, we'll get brought onto a project via the architect, and the architect wants room for the table, or wants, you know, the material to be, the paving to be like front and center, and they want the plants as a grace note, but they don't design accordingly, you know, or they'll say, I want a tree here, and we'll say, well, we need a bigger box than 18 by 18. Oh, but then if I give you a bigger box, it totally interrupts the footprint of my design. And, you know,
I trust none of these people are listening today.
Oh. Actually, I hope they are. No.
Now, we're in the business of offending our clients.
Hey, if you want to plant the right plant in the right place, it needs the right conditions.
Yeah, you can't leave us 6 inches of space. That's not fair.
Right.
You know,
I want evergreen hedges. Right. Democracy.
I want democracy in the design process. Architects cannot rule the roost.
Right.
I'm sorry. How do we bring these people into our plant world and work with them? You know, that's.
Well, I happen to be one of these people that I like both of these camps. There must be camps. I like both of them, and I think that the synergy of them. I mean, I'm speaking obviously very personally here as a plantsman and somebody who is stylistically conscious and has I believe a good eye for design, if I may say so myself. But I think that having just been on a project like building this botanical garden and working very closely with a landscape architect team, it gave me a lot of appreciation for the various perspectives that we bring to a project when that comes together. And I think one of the things that was cool about that is that, you know, over the course of the project, we kind of developed a synergy and a mutual respect that brought that to the table. So, I wish that for the world, I guess. But I think at the end of the day, there are great synergies, frankly, between these things. There are many examples, obviously, in the wild parts of the world where plants exist in a sort of cadence of chaos, and we necessarily don't want that in the landscape. We want there to be some intention or some narrative about us, because we're humans and horticulture is human. So I think there's the great opportunity to help designers and landscape architects and regardless of wherever you come from in the profession to think about more diversity in the landscape, and to think about how ultimately we're just creating greater depth and greater interest through a more provocative, maybe, use of plants in our work. And I think I think that's really the simplest case I could make in answer to that, is that the whole mission here is about increasing diversity in landscapes, because that helps everything. That helps all of us across the ecosystem. So,
well, I just, before we take a break, because we're getting to that point, but I think that what makes an amazing landscape and setting are the plants first, because
absolutely,
otherwise it's just a built environment.
That's right.
I think what makes the High Line so amazing is that it was years and years and years of architecture and plants people working together
from the beginning, not an after. So many times we're brought in at the tail end, Kelly, and so you can't. It doesn't. There isn't a synergy. You're limited,
and it's going to look stuffed in. Instead of integral.
Yeah.
And I think
that's what's key, I think. And I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I mean, it says on the back, if people flip the book over, I mean, to have a great garden, you need great plants. It's right on the back cover of the book. And I mean, it's as elemental to me as anything else. The ultimate, as you say, without that depth of plantsmanship in a landscape, it's just another built environment. And we have plenty of millions of acres of built environment on this planet today that don't evoke people, that don't don't evoke an emotion or a romanticism with the landscape. And it's amazing, even people who don't necessarily know what all the plants are and don't necessarily even have a deeper appreciation for it, I think could walk into two spaces planted very differently that are otherwise structurally the same and have two very different responses based solely on what they experienced at the planted level.
Now that would be a good test.
Well, we have to take a break, Kelly. Stay on the line. We'll be right back.
Let's play a game. If I say three words, let's say Brooklyn, classic, food. You tell me what comes to mind. I'll give you a second. If the answer wasn't Junior's, you lose the game. You can't possibly be a Brooklyn foodie, or a foodie at all for that matter, and not know about Junior's. Founded by Harry Rosen in 1950, Junior's landmark restaurant is known as the home of New York's best cheesecake. Real talk, you have not fully lived unless you've had Junior's cheesecake. The original location in Brooklyn on Flatbush Avenue is still thriving, or you can check them out at recent landmark additions in New York's Grand Central Terminal or in the heart of the Theater District on Broadway and Times Square. Check out their first restaurant outside of New York at the Fox Tower Hotel at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. It's not just cheesecakes. They've got steak, seafood, sandwiches, salad, everything you would possibly need to complete an authentic New York dining experience. Don't be embarrassed next time somebody asks you if you've been to Junior's. Visit juniorscheesecake.com for more information.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
Hi, welcome back to Weeding Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Our guest today is Kelly Norris, a rising young star of American horticulture. Kelly Norris has just written a brand new book, which I'm holding in my hands right now, Plants with Style, published by Timber Press.
It's on fire.
It's on fire. I'm holding it. It's hot. It's like very hot in my hands right now.
Hot potato.
So Kelly, your book is not, let's get into the meat of the book now. Your book is not a step-by-step kind of design how-to book. And I found myself kind of reading it in bits and pieces, and I really liked that. I found myself kind of meandering through the chapters and kind of putting little sticky notes on plants that I wanted to try. And it was refreshing in that regard. How do you, that's how I use it. How do you think that the reader should approach the book to get the most out of it? Did I kind of do it right?
Did Carmen do it wrong or right?
You've completely fallen into my trap.
Oh my God!
Here's the thing. I think there's a couple of things about that. One is, I didn't want to write a how-to book. There is as much that can be had in a five-minute Google search about any one of these 325 plants in this book as I could ever have think about writing on the printed page. And there's as much that's probably ever been written about most of these things on printed pages already that you can find now produced in, on Google Books or something. I mean, I think about this book as a passport. It's a passport to a palette, a plantsmanship, a stylistic set of ideas that leads you to be curious for more. And it's like a box of chocolates. It's this little sort of box you can open up and you can nibble on a few morsels. You can close it again and open it once more and find a whole new cast of ideas and thoughts worth craving. And you know, the reality is that so many of our gardening books are technical and kind of bland, and they're not necessarily very literary. And I suppose one of the things I thought a lot about when I was writing this book, and I wrote this book over a year and a half. I mean, so it was kind of a long gestation of sorts. But you know, one of the things that I thought about just kind of constantly was this idea of making it fun to read, about a garden book that you could just sit down with and open up to a page just like you did, and just start reading and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And walk away, you know, knowing something more or being at least inspired to go figure something more out.
Yeah, let me read something. I'm going to read what I think is a great example of what of your writing style that I love. It's on page 195. What Digitalis Obscura does for the heart, Digitalis Ferruginea does for the brain. It's like the bookish girl at the library that catches the attention of the all-star athlete, not because he's bowled over with beauty, but because she's interesting beyond a pretty face.
I love that you brought it to the high school level.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's like
that's what everyone relates to.
Hey, look, we're all still stuck in middle school, like yeah. emotionally, right? You know,
yeah, life is just one big High School Musical all over again.
Yes.
So,
when will I be accepted?
But then you go on to say you put, you know, sort of meat on the bone. Digitalis ferruginea, which is one that I didn't know by another name, chocolate or caramel flowered spireas. Spires of awesomeness, looks fetching in a border where it can rocket beyond its perennial companions to towering heights. So you tell a story that pulls people in. You're not just saying it's 36 inches high, it blooms between yeah. July,
right.
you know, and
no,
August.
I'm just so tired of those gardening books. I'm just, yeah. I mean, I read all of those when I was a kid, and that's great. I mean, I don't mean to critique those, because
no.
obviously
yeah.
there's obviously a very valid and critical reason why we need that kind of text. But you know, it's 2015, for God's sakes. I mean,
right.
we have access to as much information at our fingertips as we could possibly imagine. If we're going to make a choice to spend money on a book about a subject that we love or want to know more about, I think just as the message of the book is trying to convey a greater purpose about gardening, I'm trying in some very small, modest way to at least create a purposeful, meaningful, energizing experience en route to that very end. So,
all right, here's a question for you: if you could go back in time and have dinner with any famous dead botanist, horticulturalist, or plantsman from the past, who would it be? And what would you ask them? Because hopefully you will be the person for future generations.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Who would you have dinner with?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I mean, you know, there's kind of a couple ways to think about that, I guess. It probably maybe from contemporary history, you know, I would love to have met Christopher Lloyd. I never had the pleasure. Of course, I think I was a freshman in college when he passed away, and you know, I am so inspired by Christopher Lloyd, not only as the great, you know, late great British garden designer and plantsman, but as a writer. I mean, just the way he wrote about plants and the way he wrote about gardens was so personable and so jovial and lively. And it just, in some meager way, attempt to adopt that mantle a little bit, because it just, he brought such a flavor to his books that that few authors that get to really do or have the opportunity to really accomplish. And so I would have just loved to have spent an afternoon with him walking around Great Dixter and just hearing him describe a landscape and the plants therein that had been such an instrumental part of his life. You know, I could easily go back farther in time and want to have a stiff cocktail with, you know, some of the great plant explorers from Western horticulture in the 20th century, you know, E.H. Wilson, David Fairchild. I mean, these people who were intrepid in their pursuit of plants in the wild across the face of the planet. I mean, I could only imagine would have had some pretty incredible stories.
Agreed on that score for sure, because Alice and I are kind of obsessed with these dead plants.
The life that they lived and the passion with which they dedicated their life and work. People don't work like that anymore, you know?
It's rare. Yeah. It's for plants. People don't work that hard
for anything.
Well, they work that hard for oil. Right?
And then, they're not having adventures.
They're navigating
their stock price, but they're not.
No, they're a special breed of people.
They're not physically in the trenches.
No.
You know?
Right.
So we talked about the personal garden. I wanted to ask you, Kelly, what public gardens or institutions do you think sort of epitomize using plants in this new modern way that you think people should visit?
Well, I
naturally Des Moines.
Well, I was just, I mean, I should probably give a nod to what we're doing here, just because we really, without ego, I guess that is truly the what drives, I think, the passion for the pursuit around here is we really want to to showcase in a very public, demonstrable way how we can create emotional, romantic landscapes that are diverse, that are rich with plant material. So I think we certainly we hope that we earn people's respect and recognition in that regard. But more closer to home for you all is than for me, at least, is Chanticleer in the Philadelphia area. Is obviously one of the mainstays of the East Coast, but is called so many times America's Garden Capital because it is truly one of the most romantic institutions that exists in public horticulture. And of course, they have a book out. I'm so pleasured to share the catalog this season's timber catalog with their book, The Art of Gardening, which is just fantastic. I think that what they're doing there is really, again, my friend Bill Thomas, who of course was kind of the lead editor on the book, just said in an interview with the Chicago Tribune over the weekend that we're really not trying to show off, anything that we have as far as resources go. We just are doing the kind of gardening that you would do at home if you had more staff. I loved that.
Oh,
I love that. I love that idea of such a pleasureful, sort of indulging kind of horticulture. And I only hope that the work of that so many of us are doing in public horticulture, in around the country in different climates and different regions and with different palettes, comes to matter and be that meaningful for society.
My own experience has been at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. They've done a lot of new
exhibits
and
display.
Yeah, their newest garden is the Discovery Garden, which is very different. From the kind, that's a venerable institution, over 100 years old, basically.
The first children's garden.
They are really reinventing themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
And really thinking about people's experience. And my experience in that garden as a docent has been, even though it's technically for children, mm-hmm. adults adore it, And I've had, and they've filled the space and visited in equal numbers with kids. And I've had as many interactions with adults as I had with kids. They're just as interested, just as passionate, and in this romantic, naturalistic way, they're experiencing a very different botanic garden than their parents did. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
There's not like tons of plant labels. There's not like rows of things. They aren't organized by plant families. It's completely different experience. And it's great.
Yeah.
So I want to get into a little bit about the plants in the book. There's so many great plants. Like I said, the book is like filled with like sticky tabs of plants I'm going to hunt for this season. But I know this is kind of a tough question, but if you had to pick five relatively easy to find ones for our listeners that they should try in the new year to bring some of that passion into and excitement into their own gardens, which would you choose, Kelly?
Oh my gosh!
I know it's hard.
Well, I tell you what, if you say five, that means I've got to pick one from each chapter because there are five chapters in the book.
Exactly.
let's do that. Let's start with listeners should know that I'm just truly doing this ad hoc. I have a copy of my book in front of me. Let's talk about milkweeds from the first chapter of the book about environment. Milkweeds obviously are the poster children these days for pollinators and butterflies and you know, that is obviously one of the principal reasons you should plant them. From a completely human standpoint, they're stunning. They're one of the most, you know, have more highly evolved floral structures than maybe a lot of flowers, which we would commonly encounter. And so they have these gorgeous little kind of almost hand-carved porcelain-looking flowers in varying colors. I mean, in orange, of course, in the case of butterfly weed, but also Asclepias purpurascens, these sort of, you know, rose and purple-colored flowers. And these are tough plants. I mean, these are plants that put down tremendous taproots. They're resilient by evolutionary cause. I mean that is just the nature of the beast and as it relates to these plants. So they're long-lived. They're probably going to outlive most gardeners anyway when you install them somewhere. And so not only can we take a lot of summer delight out of them, too, they also feed pollinators along the way, which is certainly an important thing, too. Now, the second kind of chapter of the book is all about structure. And I take a very liberal definition of structure. I don't think it just is exclusively applied to trees and shrubs, although that's probably how people traditionally think about the bones of the garden. There are such things as herbaceous structure that I think are kind of the bold and bodacious sorts of plants that come to form the kind of the occasional chairs, the sofas of the garden in some ways.
Right.
I'm a big fan of Silphiums. I'm of course terribly biased because I'm a Midwestern boy, and so Silphiums are these Aster family members. They're big, they're herbaceous, they're kind of loud. They're almost always yellow with only one exception, which is so rare of an exception we won't even talk about it. But these are what many people for years would have pointed their nose at and called, you know, damn yellow composites or something. But you know, those DYCs have a lot of value in the garden. Not only is their architecture and their structure really just wonderful from a design standpoint to look with, they have great value. In fact, there's a project going on out at the Land Institute in Kansas that's actually pioneering the use of Silphium seeds as a substitute for sunflower oil. As crazy as that is to think about. So these plants surprise us. So they don't read the same books we do, and there are all kinds of opportunities to incorporate these plants for great value, for seed crops, for wildlife, as well as for our enjoyment. The middle, you know, the third chapter of the book is called Emblems. And when I was working on the book, my editor was just really keen on making sure I spelled out exactly what I meant by emblems. And I really feel most people get this pretty easily. I think if you stop and you think about the garden at different points of the year and imagine it as a bit of a calendar, as a bit of a sort of cyclical, rotation of plants that come into their moments and sometimes only last for a brief spell in the garden, you can start to think of plants that really truly come to define the season that they shine in. It's asking things like, you know, what do you think of when you think of May? And people say, oh, I think of irises, I think of peonies, I think of lilacs.
Right.
August, and you think of goldenrod, sunflowers.
Yeah.
You know, there are plants that just truly, with a garden without them would seem almost as if it was stagnant, that it was not in motion. And so, of course, as a the obvious answer I could give you would be irises, but I'm not going to do that. So,
I'm going to
shine the light on lilies for a minute because I think there's a great renaissance of lilies in American gardens right now. There's great hybrids out there. They smell fantastic. They attract sphinx moths.
I do love them.
I like the crinum lilies from the south.
Oh, crinum? I love crinum. Love crinums. That's another great choice from the book, too.
So then chapter 4... What are you thinking?
Yeah, so the last two chapters of the book, the chapter 4 kind of brings it all together. I told somebody the other day that the whole book could have been chapter 4. It's um, It's called Vignettes, and it's really about bringing the pieces together. And it, even though it's probably the most designy of the chapters in the book, I still find plenty of space to actually talk about specific groups of plants and specific kinds of things. I talk a lot about, there's a section at least in chapter four that talks about tropicals.
And, yes. Yeah.
Obviously, when you manage an 18,000 square foot conservatory, you come to be pretty fond of a lot of tropical plants, even if you can't grow them heartily outside.
Right.
So I'm a big fan of aroids. I love alocasias and colocasias. I love that sort of textural pizzazz that kind of brings an otherworldliness to gardens where you just wouldn't expect them, frankly.
Right.
And then the final chapter of the book is kind of fun because it's kitsch.
Yeah.
It's the... they're the well-placed contradictions. They're the serendipitous moments that really can give a garden a lot of personality. One of my favorite plants that I think of immediately when I think of that chapter is Pelargonium sedoides, one of these little species geraniums. It's not particularly scented. The leaves don't smell, are not herbal in a way that we would think of other scented leaf geraniums. But its flowers are these little flecks of black and mahogany, and that really invite close inspection. And I think in small gardens in particular, we have to remember that because of the scale alone, some of the greatest interest and capacity of the garden in terms of its aesthetics take place on a very finite and very intimate scale. And I think that those details can really help people connect in a very emotional and unique way that other plants that might be like a tree might not be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love that you included that because I actually grew that plant and I love it.
Yeah.
it's
great. It's just sweet. Well, Kelly, we could talk to you for hours, obviously, but we've come to the end of the show and I'm so glad that you joined us and took all this time to share
your
ideas. And you wrote the book.
Your voice is so strong.
It's so clear and
necessary.
And the book is available now, right? I mean, it's out there.
It is available now. You can probably still get it in time for Christmas.
Okay. And I also want to make a kind of a comment about the photography. I think you've done all the photography in the book as well, right?
I have.
And
I
it
have,
is
yes.
gorgeous.
Yeah.
Gorgeous, gorgeous.
Thank
so
you.
For that alone, you know, besides all the information and inspiration, the photography is amazing. And I want to kind of end the show by reading from your conclusion. The first two paragraphs, which I think it really, really encapsulates very well what the book is about. And you say, horticulture is about people, plants, and passion, and in that order. It's an act of humanity born from passionate interaction with plants. In the course of this book, I hope I've connected those dots to a more fertile result. No matter how you cut it, gardening is contrived. No matter the ingredients, no matter the context, the result is always art, a fruitful, beautiful place for living in general, and reveling in fine plants specifically. It may evoke nature, even attempt to recreate it, but it's still a human enterprise, which makes it all the more important to choose to live with the earth, not against it. No gardener has ever set out to harm the earth, but we do sometimes find too many reasons to do battle against it.
Oh.
And on that note,
inspirational.
I thank you, Kelly. Beautiful words.
Well, thank you for your work.
Thank you. And thanks for being
it's
on the show.
It's been a great privilege.
Okay.
We'll talk to you in the new year, Kelly.
So
all right. Take care.
So you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. This is our last show of 2015. But we need your help.
Help us raise money for Heritage Radio Network. Become a member. Help us on We Dig Plants continue our work by becoming a member and also by participating in our survey, which is linked on our Facebook and Instagram accounts. It gives us a lot of feedback about the show and we...
helps it make it better.
And we greatly value your opinion. So it's a quick survey. We're giving away 5 books to
randomly selected people.
Friends.
And we really want to hear your thoughts. Like, do it. This is our last chance before the end of the year. So yeah, and it's been our privilege to be on the airwaves this year again. And we're looking forward to starting 2016. We have some super exciting guests lined up that we can't wait to share with you, and we'll give you some hints about it very soon.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening. See you in the garden.
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.